Good afternoon, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another recording. With this recording, we're recording episode 240, and I want to welcome everybody to the recording. I really appreciate your time with me, and I really appreciate the engagement. I want to thank all the friends that we've got out there and the friends that we're meeting along the way, such as my good friend here that we're going to get to know, our guest today. I won't break any. I won't break the ice on that one. I'm going to get my guest to introduce himself. It's a pretty interesting one. But what I want to do today is I'm sitting down with someone who spent 30 years at the intersection of fintech engineering and at global scale. My guest is Vasil Soloczuk, known across the fintech industry as Vinsolo. And he is currently and has been the CEO and founder of a company called Insart, a fintech business accelerator based in Boca Raton, with roots tracing back to 1993 at an original partnership with IBM. We'll get to know all that stuff. We'll dig into it. Vince and his team have worked hands-on with more than 20 fintech companies, helping them modernize legacy platforms, build AI-driven and cloud-native products, and launch services that have to work across borders, languages, regulatory regimes. Obviously, as you guys know, when you're talking about finance, you have many regulatory issues across borders, so you got to respect that. All this at the same time providing the services and the software to their customers. His client lists include Advisor Engine, a Franklin Templeton subsidiary, Mirador, which was acquired by iCapital and Celsa Labs, backed by Excel KKR. And Vince have helped fintech founders save tens of millions of dollars in engineering costs while pushing their collective valuation past $100 million. I want to welcome Vince to the conversation. I want to welcome you all to the conversation. My objective today is a few items. One is we want to get to know Vince a little bit and bring him closer to the channel, perhaps make him a friend of the channel by the time we finish this conversation. And also we want to get to know what business Vince is in and what his business is and how can he support and how can he work with B2B and in a variety of ways, and we'll dig into that, no problem. We've done the research here at the channel. We've got a few interesting questions lined up for Vince. Also, I want to make sure that by the end of this conversation, you, the audience, have had well-rounded experience and knowledge about what Vince does and his company does. And hopefully, by the end of this, you'll get to know or you'll be excited enough to want to connect with Vince, and we'll provide all that information down the road when we do the post-editing. Is that fair enough to get started, Vince?
Robin, thank you very much for this very deep and meaningful introduction, and hello, everyone. Really excited to be on this podcast today, and yeah, let's discuss.
Let's discuss it. Let's get into it. Vince, as we get started, the first question that everybody gets on this channel is the following. Every one of us has a story. Just for the audience who don't know you, and many of them don't, and probably by the end of this conversation will everybody get to know you, what is your story? How did this all start? What's your personal story, personal journey? Walk us through where you started and where you are right now.
Absolutely. So, my story is all about helping founders to start their business, to scale and grow. So this is the most exciting thing I can ever do in my life, okay? So yes, at Insart, we're a B2B fintech business studio. So we help founders to build the B2B technology, business intelligence, financial analytics, reporting solutions. But we do not build just software. We help founders to build the business. And especially, I like to work with first-time founders because at this point of time, they have an idea, they have done their homework researching the market, and they have this energy and passion to build something new. But what we have learned is that most of them, they still don't have some blueprint how to build the business, okay? And that's basically something we help founders to do. So we provide the blueprint, we provide the founders execution support, enabling them to get initial traction, to validate the market, to validate their solution, their product, and eventually to scale them to the next level. So that's basically my story. That is what I do for the last 20 years. And yes, I like mostly I'm focused on financial services because I also believe that everybody in the world, they should have the tools for their financial freedom and financial independence. And that is my personal passion, to help founders to build this kind of tools so that we can provide more access to people, to companies, with all financial services we have. Portfolio management, investing tools, payment tools, like easier easier managing their corporate and personal finance, de-risking their investments, all kind of compliance things. So, and even nonprofit. So we even have several clients in nonprofit space helping to with the fundraising. So that is my personal passion, to help build this kind of tools for financial independence. And we can go to many different stories about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Vince, how did this all started for you? I know from when I did the research on the company Insert, it started around 1993 as an IBM hardware training partnership. Then it evolved into software development company, then repositioned in 2024 to a full fintech business accelerator. So for you personally, were you working like for IBM at the time, or how did this all started for you?
Yeah, so as probably this is the story for many companies who are on the market for many years. So my company was started by my father in 1993. And he started the company with the idea to build something we call Institute of Advanced Research and Technology. So this is the and INSART is basically the short name, Institute of Advanced Research and Technology. Through the last 30 years, we've gone through many different milestones, and we have done many different pivots of the company. So basically, the company that existed in the 90s, now it's totally different company, okay? Still, the corporation in the 90s, my father was a business partner of IBM, and Insert was a business partner of IBM back in Ukraine. Originally, the company was established in Ukraine. And my father built a great relations with IBM as a business partner, implemented a number of very, very complex enterprise level projects, predominantly in the banking space, helping banks in Ukraine to leverage the IBM technology, like from the mainframes and hardware to software, to business software. So basically, in early 2000s, I took over the company once I graduated from the university. I took over the company from my father, and I went international with Insert. So basically, we eventually incorporated in the United States. And since 2015, we are now a US-based company, okay? But we also leverage our expertise in enterprise software development, but now to build the solutions on much earlier stage. So we predominantly work with the early stage startups, scale-ups, and B2B mid-sized companies, helping mid-sized companies to modernize their platforms, helping scale-ups to accelerate their product roadmaps, and helping early stage startups to get started, build, validate the market, and build their MVPs.
You know, listening to the story of Insert and how you guys were involved, your father before you and now you, I guess at the early stage with IBM and deploying their technology back in the 90s, I remember my first job was working at an insurance company here in Canada, and I was in the actuarial department. I was doing actuarial analysis for them. And I remember my job was to deploy programs and database-related stuff on an IBM mainframe. Now, this is like way back in the early 90s. And we were using IBM. I remember the model was 3090 mainframe, the 3090 mainframe back in the days. And for those of you today, probably your mobile phone has now today has more storage and processing capability than the IBM 3090 back in the day. So this is how far this thing goes. But it's such a trajectory for you.
So that's exactly the mainframes that we also deployed back in Ukraine in the 90s.
Oh, really? That's the one?
Yes.
There you go. what a coincidence. That's great. Now, from you know, I don't know if you recall this because you took over the company but let me ask you this question anyway. You probably can remember this. What was the specific moment that or client engagement that told you Insart needed to stop being a dev shop that does fintech and start being a fintech only accelerator? Or are you still doing both? I don't know.
Look, so I would say we're still doing both. And what I want to talk about is you mentioned that we work for the IBM and you worked also for the corporation. And that's a very interesting story that we see with many different founders. And the typical story is an expert in their niche. They work for the financial institution for many years, maybe for a decade. And in their 30s or even 40s, they decide to start their own business because they have seen many different gaps, many different problems that are not being solved yet by the larger corporation. And these are the most successful founders, even first-time founders that I have seen. Someone who worked in the industry, someone who learned about the gaps, about the challenges, about the problems that are not being solved, and now they're building something to basically resolve these problems with their solution. So that's why I think this is very important for the founders, especially in B2B and fintech space, to actually have this kind of experience working for the enterprise. Okay, if you're not working for the enterprise, you're not seeing all the variety of problems in the market. So that's why that's just the narrative I'm seeing within all the successful founders that we work with.
Now, let me ask you this question. So if let's assume a fintech or financial service company comes to you with a legacy platform, and I know there are many of them still around. They're still running, you know, some people still running spreadsheets for heaven's sakes. Mm-hmm. What's the first thing you look at for you to decide whether to modernize incrementally or rebuild from scratch? Do you give that advice or you just build what they ask you to? How do you assess the situation?
So there are several angles. I would say that a year ago, maybe like 2 years, even a year ago, I would answer very differently to your question. Okay. So before that, I would say do not rewrite everything from scratch. So the most successful cases we have with our clients is when we gradually upgraded the technology, but not rewriting the whole platform from scratch, because one, you need to invest into rewriting, and second, you will need somehow to switch from the older platform to the new platform, and you need to proceed with all the client migration, client migration project, which could be an additional hurdle. So that's why the most successful cases we have seen is like gradually rewrite what you have, okay, but not like from scratch. However, just from return on investment perspective. However, now the situation dramatically changing with the all AI tools that we can use for software engineering. So basically, implementing AI software development lifecycle is a must-have. So it's not like an option. It's not like something good to have, something good to try. It's already a must for all engineering companies. So if you're not doing that, you're out of the business maybe in 1 year. So that's why like implementing AI software development lifecycle in all your software development processes is a must. With saying that, now we're having an option to actually fully rewrite the system from scratch. And we can do it for like 10 times, 100 times less budget than even like 2 years ago. So now when we are considering, okay, we have a legacy platform, we have a business, we have like a fintech B2B business, software business. with a legacy platform, which is an established business. They have an established client base, but they have a level of technical debt that need to be eliminated. And now they're thinking, okay, whether we rewrite or whether we continue to gradually upgrade our technology and our technological stack. Now we do have an option when the full rewrite will be actually much more efficient from the cost perspective and return on investment perspective than gradually upgrade the system. Because now you can use AI native software development cycle, life cycle to do this rewrite. And I will tell you, one of our clients we're working with, so they were somehow struggling to upgrade their technology and keep up with the market, okay? Because when they started like 15 years ago, they were pretty competitive. There were almost no competitors at the market. They were very innovative. They introduced all the machine learning and to customer segmentation and like market analysis tools. But then they lost the competition because other players, other rivals emerged in the market. And for the last several years, they were trying to keep up with the competition and they were failing. However, during the last half a year, they have fully rebuilt their platform and we helped them also to rebuild this platform just from scratch using all kind of AI engineering tools that are now available. And they have already relaunched this platform. I wouldn't imagine we can do it like even 2-3 years ago that fast.
Using the old traditional way of coding, right?
Yes, absolutely. So that's why, to answer your question now, definitely I would consider the full rewrite, improving the all layers of architecture, starting from user experience back to all the infrastructure. But again, you need to be cautious with like implementing and still the human judgment is very important when you're rewriting and when you're building a system. But the time to market dramatically increased with all the AI tools.
Vince, the old model of development or software development in general or system development in general was specifically for North Americans. You will have a beachhead in North America and you'll have your development centers across the globe, whatever cheaper. And I interviewed several people on this podcast and they gave me several ideas. One is you can either outsource the entire thing to India, it doesn't matter which country, to get a cheaper labor to get it developed, or that's called offshoring. That's what I've been told. That's what I was educated on by my guest on this channel. The second thing is you could do nearshoring, meaning that we will give it to somebody like here on the Americas, maybe Argentina or somewhere in South America, and we'll bring it closer to. We'll get a part of that development back to North America to be vetted, to be edited, whatever you want to call it, and then we put it back into production. With what you're describing using the AI model, do we still have to go through that process of having low-cost development area outside of North America, or can we just now substitute all this by using AI? And the flip side of that question is, how much humans still involved in the process, in your opinion?
Okay, so are we talking about the early stage? What stage of the companies are we talking about? Because I would say the answer would be a little bit different, whether it's an early stage startup, mid-sized company, or a larger enterprise.
So in this case, I'm talking about startup to mid-size.
Okay, so startups to mid-size. First of all, I would say there are plenty of talents all over the world. So frankly speaking, it doesn't matter what region you work.
So yeah, it doesn't matter. But the idea was low cost outside of North America. North America, the cost is a bit higher to develop.
Yes, yes. So that's why, again, there are so many different talents across the globe.
Sure.
So if we are talking about, and that's why I'm saying that. So right now, I think, and this is what we see on the market with early stage startups, something that like developing MVP, okay? This was something like a very like competitive value proposition if you have an offshore team that saying like, okay, startup, they are short on money. They don't want to waste a lot of money to build the MVP. So you need to build some MVP very fast, go to clients to validate whether this is something that clients would like to use or not. So demand validation, product market fit validation. And that's why going offshore was a very efficient way to optimize the cost for building MVP. So what we have seen right now, that one person, maybe two persons, they can develop something that like for maybe 2-3 months, something that the team of like five people would build for half a year, even 2-3 years ago. So that's why the landscape for building the MVPs changing dramatically. So it's already changed during the last 12 months. Okay. And probably it would be controversial. I think, and this is again what we are seeing, that more and more founders here in the United States, they wouldn't go offshore as their primary option at all at the early stage of the company. Okay. Why? Because they can partner with a software engineer who has a lot of experience and who already educated themselves in all kinds of AI tools. And they can easily build the MVP in 1-2 months, something that they would need like half a year to build, maybe 2-3 years ago. Which leads us to the question that, okay, now we can build MVPs like X10 times faster, even more than before. And now we can validate the ideas much faster. So that's the question for the offshore outsourcing companies, how they would compete in this market. We have done some research, and you can go and you can go and look at the what's going on with the capitalization of the top 10, top 20 companies on the market. So for example, we're seeing like top companies, top offshore companies, some of them lost at least 25% of their capitalization, and up to 40, and up to even 80% of downsize in the capitalization.
Do you think this is permanent?
Specifically because of this problem.
Do you think this is permanent, that capitalization readjustment, or is it just a for now kind of thing?
So, you know, just recently, like two weeks ago, we had a foresight strategic session with a group of entrepreneurs, tech entrepreneurs, trying to analyze what's going on the market and trying to predict what are the scenarios going forward. And I would say that if you read all kind of researches, you will see that nobody can actually predict what would be in like even 12 months, because the variety of scenarios are very, very broad right now. And but what was interesting, so we have identified like two dimensions where the market is going with AI. So the first dimension is the speed of adoption. So the speed of adoption of AI technology, meaning that whether it is like just a normal speed, and the question whether the AI tools would be just a new tools as all other tools we use. And the other scenario could be, okay, AI will dramatically change the whole landscape of engineering in 12 months. Okay. So this is like one dimension, the speed of adoption of AI technology, because there could be different blockers, different hurdles in implementation. For example, compliance. There could be many different things related to compliance. And we're already seeing that governments are starting to establish some policies related to data security, data protection, etc. So the other dimension and the other question is, who will own the margins? And by who will own the margins, I mean integrators and product builders, or the platforms. And by platforms, I mean all kind of LLM, all types of LLM models and providers. So the question is, who will own the margins? And again, we're seeing that large players, large platforms, they're already partnering with the large consultant companies. There are some alliances already, and they're just going directly to large businesses to automate them. From the other hand, there are plenty of different integrators who are still valid from the business domain perspective. And again, there is no like direct answer who will own the margin, but that's something that we need to monitor. And depending, you know, what type of business model you have, you need to understand how you will adopt to this new role.
Now, Vince, you publicly spoke about, and you made quite the point regarding VCs are all in on AI. And I'm seeing that. That's, you know, everybody's seeing that how VC money is moving toward AI because they think there's, as back to your margin, they think they can create margin with AI by automation and creating a bit of a financial adjustment to the financial statements of those companies that they are involved in. But also there is a case where I think you've spoken about this one, where AI is creating a bit of a bubble, you called it, while starving other sectors of capital. So inside fintech specifically, where do you see AI genuinely earning its valuation premium where it's mostly others, they think it's narrative?
Yeah, absolutely. So speaking about VCs, and there are a couple things here. So the question number one that every VC is asking themselves about the startups, are they defensible? And especially with AI disruption going on, are they defensible? Meaning, is this startup can be replicated quickly? So is it just LLM wrapper around some AI model, okay? Is it an LLM wrapper? Is there the risk that a large platform will just absorb the startup as a feature, okay? And this is the question that all the founders need to answer themselves. Are they defensible? Are they replaceable? Okay, and what actually they own, and they need, and all the VCs, they also implement some kind of deeper technical diligence now to understand what is the ownership, starting from does they own the code, what are the open source dependencies, again data provenance, model provenance, security posture, yeah. Like, are there like hidden compliance risks? So defensibility. So this is all about defensibility. And VCs now are very cautious analyzing, is this startup defensible from built with buy risk, LLM wrapper risk, platform feature absorption risk, and also margin risks. Would the AI platforms consume all the margins? Because if it's a LLM wrapper, you will still need to pay a lot of money for using the tokens, okay? And the startup margin can be very, very thin, very, very thin. And if it's very thin margin, does it make sense? And is it like scalable? Is it a scalable solution? So maybe it's a viable solution, but maybe it's not a scalable solution just because of the thin margin if they use some kind of LLM model. So basically, again, the startups who can answer all these questions probably would be successful from the fundraising perspective. But this is number one question all the VCs are asking themselves. How defensible is this startup from the AI perspective?
Correct. And not just companies are asking the question, individuals are asking the question. I know I did a podcast a few 2 weeks ago, I think I published it not too long ago. And we were talking about the defensible zone where human are asking the question, how much of my skills are going to be gone to AI versus how much of my skills are going to keep and I'm going to harness those skills to use AI to do something better or different or bigger. Now, there is one area I want to talk about is the list of things inside fintech that you've pointed to. For instance, RegTech, fraud detection, and high-frequency trading as areas that real AI stay in power because they are hard to commoditize. Is there anything else on that list that most people are overlooking, or is this just the tip of the iceberg, or there are more details around that?
I would say that something that someone claimed like a half a year ago and even 3 months ago probably is not valid anymore.
I'm thinking 2 weeks, Vince.
Yes, because, because it's so hard to predict where we are going with the all AI disruption. Maybe it's just a bubble, or maybe this is a real disruption and the whole landscape of roles will change and solutions will change like in 6 months, in 12 months. Okay. So that's why something that worked for the last decade, maybe it wouldn't work for the next, during the next 12 months. That's why I think you mentioned if I am replaceable and what kind of skills I should have. And this is something we also reflected about. Okay. If we are having this kind of AI disruption, what kind of skills engineers and all the technology leaders and business leaders would need in AI era? And this is, I can tell you some list that we came to. First of all, concentration of attention, be able to keep the focus. And this all are like, let's say, soft skills. They are not like, or cognitive skills. They're not the specifically engineering skills, okay? So concentration of attention, focus of attention. Can you keep the focus or you are just like trying to spread your attention to many different things? Logical and system thinking. So logical and system thinking is still valid. So you can, so someone who learned to just to produce some code now can be replaced with the LLM. But if you have the logical and system thinking, you can build the complex systems. The very important skill, judgment, technical judgment, not only all types of judgment. So we still need a person, a human, to judge the results and outcomes of what is produced by LLM. Because yeah, we can to some degree we can develop our agents and they can do the judgment as well. But at the end of the day, we need to have someone who will take responsibility and take the ownership, ultimate ownership for the outcomes, all types of outcomes of the business, of the specific process, of the specific result. And here we need to have this judgment. And judgment, it's a human skill, and AI would hardly learn this skill anytime soon. So that's why concentration of attention, logic and system thinking, judgment. So these are very, very important things, very important skills of a person, of a human, to thrive in the AI era.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that we have to take ownership or responsibility of our action, which is something I spoke about with Chris Rolfe. He's the CEO and founder of a company called the Boulder Geo Marketing in Boulder, Colorado. And one of the things I was talking to him about is like, okay, you've got staff. His staff is using AI. How's that working out? He said, well, one thing is I'm meeting with my staff and I'm telling them, if you send an email to somebody, you can't say AI sent it. You're still responsible for that. If you see a mistake in an email and you can't come back to your supervisor or your manager and say, I didn't do that, AI did it. So you have to take responsibility of your action, even though we're using technology. A lot of people are defaulting to say, oh, AI did it as a system responsibility. And we can't relinquish, we can't give up our responsibility of actions that we're initiating and the system is taking on our behalf. Any comments on that?
So, you know, I have a funny story with one of my partner. He was answering to some of my emails saying, hey, you keep going, your AI is keep going to answer me my emails. So I'm not sure if I'm talking to you or to AI.
Okay.
And definitely I answered that that's basically me talking to you. But yes, I would acknowledge I do use AI to structure my emails now. And you can perfectly see that a lot of people started to do this. So that's why probably we need to put some kind of, line in your email that, yes, that is still, this email is still created by a human, but enabled by AI. So yep. I think we just need to disclose this upfront. So absolutely, that's not like 100% automated email, but that is actually me answering and writing you an email. And that's the perfect example. Someone need to take responsibility, and certainly you can't, replace yourself with the AI agent and say, "Hey, this is not me. This is AI." You need to take responsibility for your outcomes. ultimately, yes, we can automate a lot of workflows.
Yeah.
Maybe we can even get rid from some roles in our organizational chart. But mm-hmm. if you look into organizational chart, eventually there is someone who is responsible. So even if you have one person, like a lot of talks about, okay, we will have like single human enterprises soon and all the AI agents help in this human. But still, this is one single human who is responsible for the outcomes of your business and for the actions of your business. And they need to have a really, really great judgment of what is happening.
Yep.
And certainly they can't blame the agents if something goes wrong.
Yep. I'd like to ask you a question regarding this particular topic where not just in the fintech, but in every industry nowadays, and Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, talked about it, where he says, you know, AI agents don't need a layer in between now. You know, that eliminates the entire SaaS layer, in my opinion, because he's talking about AI agents accessing databases directly. What does this do to fintech companies? What does this do to the entire business model from a software perspective? I mean, I work in the language industry that's built around, we build a database and we put a SaaS layer, we put a software layer on top of that. And that's how people interface, how that's how people access the database through a layer that we call software, that he's got a user interface that you can access the data, query the data, whatever you want to do with it. But if we reduce that, if we eliminate that and get AI agents to access the database directly, what's your thoughts on where that industry, that entire SaaS industry goes? I'm hearing a lot of rumors, to be honest with you. I'm hearing rumors around SaaS industry no longer exist in a few years. I don't know, but I'd love to get your take on it.
Yeah, of course. I think that SaaS industry, meaning software as a service industry, wouldn't disappear. So the companies, they would just transform in something else. And we're already seeing what it could be. And it could be service as a software. Again, it would be SaaS, but not software as a service, but service as a software. And let me unpack, let me elaborate on that. So we can see that many VCs in their investment thesis for this year, they're looking for the companies that would automate the business of service and consulting agencies. So we can see this in Y Combinator, we can see this with Sequoia, saying that services is the new software. So what is the difference? With the software as a service, you sell seats, so you sell users. So you have you're actually selling seats to users. So the more seats you have sold, the more users the end client will use, the higher check will be. So now what we're seeing is that this model is being eliminated. But what is the next step? What would be the next? So the next would be the service as a software. And what is service as a software? So when you have an AI agent operate the software in the background and you deliver in the end service, the end result. So basically you pay for a completed result, like having an AI autonomous assistant that answers customer support tickets, or even entirely handling your bookkeeping. And you don't need, and so basically this is an opportunity for SaaS companies, and this is an opportunity for the consulting and services companies to scale their business much faster now, not hiring additional people, but actually enabling their experts with AI agents to provide more services to their clients. So that's what I think where we are heading to. Like, so we're basically switching from the software as a service to service as a software model. So that's what would be happening going forward.
And for the audience, I'd love to stop a little bit on a point that Vince spoke about, and I really always I bring it up on the channel, is AI operating the software. So keep an eye on this one and pay attention to this particular point. I've seen many in my career, many employees, they sit and they operate software in a way that really you put a couple of hamsters in and they will probably do the job. And with all due respect to everybody who's working hard, cut and pasting files and data entry and filling out screens and pressing enter on them, those are the things of the past, because now we have the ability to do this using AI, but keep your software as it is in, or modify a little bit to accommodate for the AI models to engage in this data entry or whatever you want to call it, operation of your internal software. This is very real. This is not an imagination. This is deployable technology now. This is not something we're talking about down the road in the future. Many companies are deploying this right now. So keep that in mind. The next segment I'd like to get into, if you don't mind, Vince, just keeping an eye on the clock here. I want to make sure that we address all the topics, if you don't mind. One is around, you work in a fintechs, obviously, and you work, that's regulated industry. So compliance, security, and perhaps addition to that, many companies are going global, even in the fintech world. So how do you, you know, for many founders out there, compliance is core product feature, basically, to whatever they do. And I would say in some cases, it's an afterthought. First, we develop the product. And then after that, oh, we have to put a layer of security on top of that. Maybe not, but maybe some do. But when fintech company is trying to launch multiple markets at once, in some cases, at what point should perhaps the regulation aspect of it, be it the security layers, how each country treats different transactions, et cetera, needs to come into the picture. But then again, you're localizing languages, you're localizing regional perspective on how financial compliance should be dealt with, and the architecture around that should be addressed as well. For each one of them, you can't just produce something for United States and say, tomorrow, I'm going to deploy this in Ukraine. Well, it doesn't work. There are certain aspects of it that needs to be changed. What's your comments on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, compliance is so a big topic to discuss. So probably we would
have
another huge podcast on this topic.
Absolutely.
That you have raised. However, I would like to point your attention to one very specific idea here, especially valuable for the early stage founders to mid stage companies. And this is about procurement readiness. Again, many fintechs, they sell to financial institutions. So their end client is some kind of financial institution, bank, credit union, wealth management company, registered investment advisor, insurance underwriter, etc. And that are big corporations, and they have a procurement process. And a lot of founders, they underestimate how complex is this process and how bureaucratic could be this process. But again, for the reason, because they need to verify all the compliance, they need to verify whether your solution comply with everything they need to comply with. Again, if it's an international company, if this solution would be compliant with all the local regulations and compliance. So that's why the procurement, so the founders can be stuck because of the procurement. So that's why we call this procurement readiness. So this is something that must be evaluated at the very, very early stage of the company.
Because it's part of the product, basically, you're saying. It's part of the project to begin with. It can't be after.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is something founders underestimate. You can develop a really viable solution, but because of data privacy problem or like compliance, and you can't overcome this, your solution is obsolete. And you have not, I mean, you're trying to sign...
It becomes an architectural problem, wouldn't it?
Yes, yes. So probably even some banks would agree to have a sandbox project with you, but then you're just stuck with all the procurement. So that's why founders may underestimate security, legal, data, procurement friction. And the product that demos you know, like will not be like enterprise ready. So that's why founders need to pay a lot of attention to procurement readiness in any region, in any location of the world. So that's very important.
100%. And, you know, I always talk about this on the podcast. My background is technology. Obviously, I started my career as a technologist, and I keep talking to people like, plan this. Don't do it on a Saturday afternoon and figure out I'm going to roll it out on Monday morning. Of course, there's tools to allow you to do that. But plan it well, put the architecture, design it well at the beginning. It's like building a house. you don't build a house and you make a basement and you do all the foundation work, and then all of a sudden you decide, oh, I need to add another section to my house. Well, then you need to rip it up, dig the foundation, and add another foundation piece to it. So software, designing software, building things, structuring things together, to put it this way, you have to start with a very solid plan at the beginning. And that's what Vince has been telling us today. I really appreciate stressing that point there, Vince. You also, I don't, if you don't mind, Vince, I've got to move on to another topic here. On the, you've talked a lot about bankers and ex-bankers and financial people makes good and strong fintech founders. Because also, you also said most startup fails, founders assume instead of asking. So they assume, and you know, we all know what assumption means, right? And then you also say they have launched instead of, you know, launched a business instead of sitting down and thinking about what the business looked like. It's sort of same line that we've been talking about. What does a founder need to walk into your office to do or to have? Walk into your office before Insart even start engaging with them? Do they need to have a prerequisite of things?
Yeah, absolutely. So we call it investment readiness.
Yeah.
Okay. So first of all, the founder need to acknowledge that this is a long-term journey for themselves. So what we have seen is that sometimes founders, they do not acknowledge this and they try to build their startup just as a side project or like a pet project. Frankly speaking, I have never seen a lot of success when founder was building something as a pet project. So the most success is when you are all in, then when you have all in skin in the game. Okay, so when you are just doing your startup as a full-time job for yourself. And you need to be prepared for that. You need to be prepared financially. You need to be prepared from the energy perspective and just from the moral perspective that yes, for the next 2-3 years, I do have a financial background, my personal financial background to support this journey for the next 2-3 years. So that's, I would say, the biggest, again, underestimate of founders that they can build something as a pet project and be successful. Also, the founders should have a very fast speed and they need to be hungry. So I just talked with some VC general partner and he told me, I was having a conversation with the startup founder, like 30 minutes introductory call, and I was giving him some kind of feedback or even asking questions. And just in a few minutes, and there were several founders on the call. And while the one founder was like clarifying the question and answering the question, the other founder, he was just producing an updated version of their product based on what this general partner said. And just in a few minutes, they were presenting, like asking, hey, is it something you mean? And he was amazed. So he actually decided after this 30 minutes call, he decided to invest in this team. Why? Because the speed of pivoting and, you know, producing the new features and new MVP was so fast and so amazing that they decided, okay, probably this team will make it because of the speed. And I will tell you, we talked about defensibility, and a lot of VCs, they're saying that you can't create something defensible now. And the biggest defensibility for yourself is your speed, is how fast you make decision, how fast you can refine, how fast you can process all the feedback, and how fast you can do the next iteration. So probably this would be the key points.
Yeah.
Signals, like positive signals that this founder would make it.
Yeah, like, I mean, we're all, this is exactly right. Like the positive signals that there exist out there, right? So, as a founder, I started my small company in November last year, and I'm always looking for those signals, to be honest with you. If it smells okay and I dig through the opportunity and it comes out to be okay, fine, I'll continue. But if it doesn't, I'm walking away. Time is money. I got to move on to the next thing. One of the things is like for our listeners, Vince, who are founders, let's say, listening to this podcast right now, and some of them perhaps have a great idea, but no signed LOIs or no early revenue. What do you think you should advise them on their next move today, this week? To get an investor ready.
Yes, certainly. So the biggest mistake we have also seen just from the process perspective, not because the founder is not smart, but as I said, they just don't have this blueprint and they're running in circles. So the biggest mistake we have seen, they're not doing the validation of their idea. So they are trying to sell it before they validate it. Okay. So that's why they need to change this perspective. First of all, they need to talk to clients. They need to put together even some presentation. Even they don't need an MVP, and they need to go to their 10 clients, but not asking if they will buy the product, okay? They need to ask whether they have this pain, whether they have this challenge, and ask why they would not buy this product. So now you can open the conversation with the clients, even you don't have any kind of product. But you can validate the pain, you can validate the problems, you can validate the challenges they have. And also you would validate what kind of solution they would probably looking for. I would tell you, most of the clients, again, for the most successful startups, they don't know that they would buy this solution because there is no such solution on the market. So that there is no such category, even such a category on the market. So that's why the first thing every founder should do on the early stage is to validate, but not to actually sell.
Now, for the audience, I want to mention this here as we come close to the end of our conversation with Vince. Vince runs Monday Signal Insert FinTech AI newsletter and also and FinTech Startup Demo Days. That's very interesting as well. I love to poke my head into that and see what this is about. And also, I want to mention to the audience, if you guys are interested, you can look that up and participate in the activities that Vince has put out there. I'm assuming you can subscribe to his newsletter, and that's fine, I'm assuming. And also, you can check into the Startup Demo Days. If you guys, FinTech Startup Demo Days, I love the idea of, it almost sounds like a Shark Tank, but it's more of a demo your idea, bring your idea together. And for those of you familiar with the AI Exchange Network event that takes place on Fridays, which is tomorrow at 9 o'clock in the morning. This is run by me, and I invite everybody who has an AI-related idea or experience of any sort to bring it to the conversation. We're having a great conversation and presentation by Marvin Martinez, who is from Bandsaw AI. So look us up. We'd love to have you as part of the conversation. At the same time, make sure you check out the newsletter that I just mentioned from Vince Solo and his team about FinTech. Now, I've got a question for Vince as we wrap this up. Looking at 2026, what is the one shift in FinTech, AI, or globalization that you think founder aren't paying enough attention to?
You know, I like these questions when you need to pick the one when you have a list of them.
I know.
Yes.
That's okay.
So I think that... the most disruption is and with how we work using AI tools across the company with business processes. Not only like how we develop the software, but how actually the business operates. The whole business operation system is changing because you're like replacing some roles with the agents. But I think the biggest problem is that people underestimate the soft skills, like what kind of soft skills you need to have to thrive in AI era. And I talked about them a little bit. So can you bear a lot of cognitive load? Like, can you judge? Do you have this judgment skill? What is your thinking and reflexive thinking process? So can you refine? Can you do the lessons learned? So that's why a lot of people are focused on technical implementation, like how to implement the AI agents, whatever. But I think we need to look more into what does it mean for human now to use the AI and to leverage AI from the cognitive perspective. And
Absolutely. What
kind of cognitive skills we should develop and how to develop them better so that we humans can leverage and we can augment ourselves with the AI tools. So that's, I think, is the most important thing to look into.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned something about thinking. I hear a lot about critical thinking, where people need to be practice critical thinking in terms of how we run and how do we manage these new powerful tools now that we've got access to. Now, for those who are interested in your Monday Signals, the FinTech Startup Demo Days, and for the listeners who wants to participate in this, is there a way to connect with you? How do they get involved? How do they reach out?
Yes, yeah, so the best way is to connect on LinkedIn. So I'm actively using LinkedIn. So you can just type Vince Solo or Vasil Soloshchuk, and you can find me on LinkedIn. So let's get in touch. So if you have an interesting idea, so let's discuss it. And if you need help with product development acceleration or with the platform modernization and also implementation of agentic workflow automation, business intelligence tools, so we would be happy to help.
Absolutely. And for the audience, if you try to get a hold of Vince and you can't, just send me a request and I'll be happy to make an introduction for you, okay? I am connected. I think by now we should be connected on LinkedIn. I sent you a connection request there, Vince, if you don't mind clicking it. That'd be great. And for the audience, I really appreciate your time with me. Any last comments, Vince, before we finish the recording?
Yes, of course. So, Robin, thank you very much for invitation. And I wish everyone, all tech entrepreneurs, to survive this next AI wave. And I would like to wish you to keep building the brighter financial future. So let's keep building the fintech and brighter financial future together. So thank you, and let's stay tuned.
Absolutely. Thank you, Vince. I really want to thank Vince Solo for joining me today to record episode 240. I really appreciate your time with me, Vince. And hopefully we can count you amongst the friends of the channel and going forward. I really appreciate your preparation, your time, dedication for this conversation. And for the audience, I want to thank you so much for listening in. If you're coming on our YouTube channel, thanks for watching us. Also, if you're coming on our audio channels, thanks for listening in. And if you're reading the blog post where I summarize and archive these conversations into a written format, very small, short, consumable formats of one page, you can see the summary of what Vince and I have talked about, or you can research other podcast episodes that we've published before. Feel free to check it out, robinayoub.blog. You can find all that information. Thank you so much, everybody. And I want to thank, on your behalf, I want to thank Vince Solo for joining me today. Thanks for your contribution to this conversation. And I will see you guys at the next episode. Thanks, everybody.